All right. Some of you are like, why in the world? Well, there's two reasons. One, if we have the opportunity to show a clip from one of the greatest movies ever, those of you who've never seen it, you're like, you got to be kidding. Some of you who have seen it, you're like, you got to be kidding. Three Amigos said it is one of my favorite movies. Funny, funny, funny. But here they encounter a singing bush in the desert. And here's the big connection. We're going to do a story about a guy who finds a talking bush in the desert. That's about all I got, but it was fun. So is it okay to have a little fun in church? But, you know, I mean, at the end, he probably felt as nuts as we think those guys were. We're going to be looking at a story about a guy who meets God, who has what's called a theophany. And I'll talk about that in a minute. I want to tell you about a couple things real quick, a couple quick announcements. I know we're going to have announcements later in the service. And so this isn't a steal the thunder from those. But I just want to highlight a couple things real fast that just to encourage you to do some things. First of all, there are invite cards for Easter. Studies have shown that the time where people are most likely to visit a church to come hear the gospel is on Easter and Christmas. And so we actually, rather than being like, I can't believe all those people only show up for Easter and Christmas, we think it's a good time because at least they're going to come hear the gospel. We'll be praying that God opens the hearts of people who don't come on a regular basis to any church. We want them to come on Easter and hear the gospel clearly. And we're going to have a fun service, an interesting service. And so we want to encourage you to take these. These are on the information table. It just says Easter is coming, 10 a.m., Eureka High School. Join us for Easter Sunday. We'll have Krispy Kreme donuts that morning. So whoever you invite, tell them to meet you about 15, 20 minutes early so I can get a couple donuts for them and their kids. And then invite some people to come celebrate Easter with us. These are out there, very easy just to hand out to friends, neighbors, people that you know, perfect little invite. Second thing is our Good Friday service. Make sure you look at that in a bulletin. We'll get more information later and maybe an announcement about this. But the deal is this is a really big deal for our church and a great chance for us to live out the gospel. We're serving a really cool pastor and a really beautiful church in a pretty tough neighborhood. We're going to do some construction level projects. We're also going to do a giant block party for kids in the neighborhood. It's just a great place. Pastor Sean and New Beginnings Fellowship in Hazelwood, primarily an African-American congregation. So it's just going to be a great chance for us to go and really live out the meaning of Good Friday. So let me just challenge you. Good Friday, go with us, okay? See information bulletin, do that. The last thing I want to announce to you real quick is next Sunday, I am uber excited because I get to sit out there with you and Michael Shattuck is going to get to give his first sermon to Genesis next week. So make sure you come next week. If you haven't met Michael and Vicky, they're part of our church now and he's going to be planting a church in a little over a year, around a year from now, or I'm not sure how long, but somewhere in that time frame. But he's doing an apprenticeship with us and he's going to preach next week, and it's going to be really cool, and he's going to stay in the series we're in, so make sure you come back next week. I'm excited for that, Michael. I'm looking forward to it. This morning, like I said, we're looking at a crazy, crazy story in the Bible as the Bible introduces one of the biggest characters in the entire story of the Bible. We're doing a series right now. If you've been hanging out with us, you know this, where we're looking at the Old Testament specifically and really these huge stories, these stories that if you grew up in church, you heard these stories. You may have gone to Sunday school and had them taught to you. You may have had a kid's Bible and had them read to you by your parents. But these big stories from the Old Testament that kind of set up the story of God. And a lot of times when we, you know, if you're like me and you grew up in church, they were almost like Aesop's fables where you just kind of read a story and it was kind of its own standalone little deal and had some kind of moral that I was supposed to gather from the story. And what we're trying to do is we're kind of trying to kind of change the way you see these stories. Because really, it's not that each story has its own standalone moral, and we're supposed to find the moral of the story and then be like the character. What we really find is that each small story is part of a huge story, and that there is this, if you want to call it a low story of the life of a person, but there is a high story where God is accomplishing something huge, and that story keeps moving towards a goal, and that goal is that God is eventually going to send Jesus. And so what happened is the story kind of picked up, we read about the creation, that God made everything, and then Adam and Eve, the first two people, said, listen, I don't want a God, I want to be God. I want to live at the center of my own existence. I don't want any God telling me what to do. I'm going to run my own show. We find out that is all of our problem, that we are disconnected from God because at the core of who we are, we don't want a God, we want to be God. And what happens in the story is that in the midst of this, after we see this downward spiral away from God, that God steps back into the story and he calls this man named Abram, later changes his name to Abraham, gives he and his wife a miracle baby when he's 99 and she's 90 years old. And it starts a journey where God makes a whole ton of promises to this guy named Abraham. He makes a bunch of promises, and these promises, some of them were kept in Abraham's life. Most of them, the rest of the story of the Bible is about God keeping these promises that he made to Abraham. And so what happens is this man becomes a family. And that family ends up in Egypt. And we ended with the Joseph story last week. And at the end of the book of Genesis, when the story of this guy named Joseph ends, this family is about 70, 75 people strong. And they're living in Egypt. Joseph is kind of the key leader of God, of the nation. He's like second in line to Pharaoh to leading this entire nation. He becomes a very important person through some crazy events. And God orchestrates the events of his life to put him in this situation and to get the people in Egypt. Well, what's going to happen as we read the story is we're going to pick up the story of this guy named Moses. But the thing you got to know is that when Genesis ends and Exodus begins, there is a 400-year gap. And this family of 70 have become a people of hundreds of thousands. And those people who are is a huge, huge group. And the numbers, you know, there's a little difference on how many actually there are. Some even would say it's in the millions. It is a huge population of people that are all the descendants of this guy named Abraham, who God promised, I will make of you a great nation. And now there's this huge core of people, but there is a gargantuan problem. And the problem is that these people are now in slavery. It's been a 400-year gap. The king who's in power now, the Pharaoh who's in power now, does not remember Joseph. He doesn't remember the story of Joseph. And just to put this in perspective, okay? Just to think, okay, 400 years, how long is that? Because sometimes you read it, you kind of hit the end of Genesis, and then you jump to the next chapter, and you're like, okay, the story keeps going. Man, look how much has changed. So let me give you some perspective on this. Between the last verse in Genesis and the first verse in Exodus, it's about 400 years. The Mayflower landed on Plymouth Rock in 1620. Now, those of you who know math, how long ago was that? Roundabout number. 400 years. We get the same amount of human history as the entire story of our country. From the time the first settlers showed up until today is the gap in time. And look at America. America went from a few native people and one boat full of people to a nation of millions. This isn't hard to fathom. These people they've been fruitful and multiplied, which is what the Bible said they were to do. They are filling the earth. It was one of God's commands. They're becoming this people. Now they are this people. They have this ancestry of a God who spoke to their fathers, but now they feel disconnected. They feel alone. They feel like they're God has forsaken them, and they are in a brutal, brutal slavery. Meanwhile, this guy Pharaoh, who's the king of Egypt, begins to see that this mass of people, if they ever got a crazy idea of revolting and starting a revolution, Egypt would be in trouble because there are so many of these people. And so in his mind, he goes, man, if we don't oppress them, if we don't put them down, if we don't make life tough on them, they're going to revolt. And so he does what most people in power do. He leads with the idolatry of power and says, the only way to keep my power is to do injustice to people. And the Hebrew people go through one of the worst times of slavery in all of history. And it is out of this story that God calls another man, a guy named Moses. And what happens is that the next, actually four books of the Bible unpack the story of Moses, unpack his work and how God uses him and delivers these people from slavery and makes them a nation, his people. And God is going to act on their behalf. And so the story of Moses begins in Exodus chapter 1. He's born, cute little baby. But here Pharaoh goes the next step and says, not only do we need to make their work hard, not only do we need to oppress them, not only do we need to push the Israelites down, but now they're multiplying so fast that if they raise up an army of their men, we're in trouble. And he decides we're going to do genocide. We're going to kill the baby boys in this culture. We're going to get rid of all the young male children. If they have a baby girl, that's fine. But if they have a baby boy, we're going to kill this baby boy and get rid of him. And Moses is born into that situation. And his mom wanting to honor God, wanting to do what's right, and loving her child. I mean, I can't imagine living at a time where you would have to make a choice if your child was born and it was a little boy, or in a place like China now, where if your child is born and it's a little girl, you have to decide, do I just let this child die? Do I give it over to the authorities and be obedient to my governing authorities? Or do I basically break the law and do what's right? And Moses' mother wrestles with this, but she does what's right. She creates a system where she's hiding him. And then eventually he gets too old to hide in the house. And so she builds this basket and fills it with basically pitch or tar so that it will float and it'll be watertight. And every day when it's kind of time and they begin to see soldiers come around and people who might like come in and raid their house, they slip down to the river. They find a place where they can put this baby in a basket in the reeds and kind of hide the baby, and they leave it there. And his older sister is watching the basket just kind of at a distance so that she doesn't bring attention to it. And one day this basket drifts and the craziest thing happens. That the daughter of Pharaoh is bathing herself in the river, and she looks down and she hears the baby crying. She sees the basket and she sees the baby, and her heart is just immediately drawn to the basket, drawn to the baby. And her decision is, I'm going to take this baby and care for this baby as my own. And so the outcome is that now Pharaoh's daughter has a Hebrew baby that she is going to raise, but she goes, listen, the baby needs a nanny. The baby needs a caretaker. And Moses' sister, thinking quickly, jumps in and says, I know the perfect nurse, the perfect nanny, the perfect babysitter for your baby. And Moses grows up in such a way that he actually has his foot in both worlds. He has one foot in the Hebrew world being raised by his mom, and a foot in the Egyptian world being raised also as a son by Pharaoh's daughter. And he grows up in this situation where he's a little bit both. Natively, he is Hebrew, but he's trained in Egyptian culture and Egyptian thought and Egyptian training, and he really has his foot in both worlds. Well, what happens out of this is that when Moses gets old, so the story jumps forward, Moses is older, and now one day he is out and he is walking, he is paying attention to things in the world, and he sees a couple of Hebrews getting beat up by an Egyptian. And it's at this point where he begins to wrestle with his identity, and he makes a decision that day on who he really is. He sides with God's people, he sides with the Hebrews, and he kills the Egyptian who are harming these two Hebrew people. And as we read it, what we see is something that it on face value, we're like, yes, here he is, Moses, the deliverer. And my guess is from Moses. In fact, Stephen in the New Testament, Acts chapter 7, gives a speech where he unfolds a story. And he hints at this, that Moses at this point in time believed he was God's deliverer. He was going to be the great hero. He was going to be the Martin Luther King Jr. of the day, who were going to lead the people out of oppression. They would rise up and follow him. He is now going to be the great hero of those people. But what happens is actually radically opposite of what he thinks will happen. And we have another situation. If you were here the week we talked about the fall, and I told you that they're all through the Bible's fig leaf stories. Stories where we think God ought to act, but he isn't doing it the way I think he should do it. So I go and I try to solve it for God. We have a fig leaf story here. As Moses tries to do something that only God can do. And he ends up really messing it up. And the outcome is that the next day he's among some Hebrews and he thinks, man, I can step in. They ought to know that I'm for them now. And he steps in and he tries to take two Hebrew people who are arguing and be kind of the middleman, the mediator between them. And as he does this, the Hebrews look at him and go, who made you our judge? Who made you in control? And Moses realized that they know that he has killed an Egyptian. And he also realizes not only are they not going to accept him as a leader, but probably Pharaoh knows it. And sure enough, he does. And Moses has to flee. He has to leave everything. And this boy who was raised in culture, raised in luxury, raised with a silver spoon, raised with everything, now has to flee Egypt. And he ends up kind of in the backside of the desert, out in the middle of nowhere, hanging out. And he ends up serving this other family as a shepherd. I mean, think about this. He was in the royal family. And the next stage of his story, he is out in the middle of the desert watching sheep day after day after day. And in his life, his whole mindset is probably, this is not the way I saw my life going. This is not where I thought this would end. I mean, I had dreams. I thought, especially, like, I believe in God. I know the stories of the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and God of Jacob. I know the promises he made Abraham. I thought I was the dude. I thought I was going to be the deliverer. I thought God had raised me up for this. And now I'm lonely in the desert watching sheep. And it is out of that situation that God steps back in the story and calls Moses, and everything changes. And so we're going to read a story this morning where God speaks to Moses. And as God speaks to Moses out of a burning bush, God literally shows up. And so here's what is going on here. We have a story that's called a theophany. Theophany basically means an appearance of God, where God shows up in a tangible, very real way, and he speaks to Moses. In a, like, not a mystical, you hear it from the clouds, not a dream. There is going to be a tangible thing that happens. And out of this tangible event, Moses is going to speak to God. He's going to see God face to face. And so if you have a Bible, grab one. Bibles at the end of your rows. If you don't have one, we'll be in Exodus 2 and 3 this morning. We're going to read through parts of the story. I'm going to explain what's going on. And then we're going to connect the dots because God is doing something so huge, so big. So grab your Bible, find that. Exodus chapter 3, and just realize that this is what's always going on in the Bible. There are always two stories. This is what's going on this morning. There are always two stories. We get caught in our story. And one of the stories we see in the Bible is the low story, or the story about people, the story about lives, the story about what's going on. And in the low story this morning, we have people, individuals, maybe millions of people, where their personal story is, I am in slavery, my life is horrible, I work long, long hours and nobody gives a rip, and they beat me when I don't do it exactly the way they want to. Our babies are dying, our lives are horrible, and there is no way out. That is their low story. Moses' low story, his little story is, I grew up in the palace and now I am lonely doing nothing but sitting on sheep. My life is being wasted. My life is not what I thought it would be. And what happens is that the Bible keeps showing us the lower story. We see these people and they are real people, real circumstances, real events. And our lives are here this morning and you have a low story. And your story, it probably involves brokenness, heartache, doubt, frustration, hardship. And you live in a low story, and sometimes that's all we feel like we can see. That's all we know. I mean, our whole lives are, it's not the way I thought it would be. I've made a mess of my life. Everybody's against me. My life is really hard. My job is not working. My life is being wasted. I did not see my life going the way. It's not what I dreamed. Can you resonate with that this morning? And we live our lives in this low story. But always in the Bible, and if you don't see this, you'll miss the point. There is the story of God. The story where God is orchestrating the events of everything, and he is rescuing and redeeming his people. He is working. And where God seems silent, he is not. And God is always moving everything in the story towards his purposes and plans. And when we're lost in our little story, and that's all we can see, we won't experience God. We will think God is failing us, or we will reshape God to fit our view of how our lives ought to be. And we'll miss everything. But when God opens our eyes and we meet him, and we begin to see the big story, we begin to realize that there is a God, that God is at work, that God is orchestrating my life and part of his big story. But the story that I need to focus on doesn't need to be mine, it's his. When we begin to see that and live our lives with that story being the one that our focus is on, our dreams are on, our hopes are in, we will begin to see that God really at work and him using us and doing beautiful, glorious things. And that's what the burning bush is really all about. So grab your Bibles and let's read through the story of God calling Moses on the backside of the desert as he speaks out of a bush that is burning. So chapter 2, we're going to begin with chapter 2. Read verses 20, start with verse 23 there. It says, during many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery, and they cried out for help, and their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. Listen, two things are happening here. First of all, out of their groaning, out of their brokenness, there's now a new Pharaoh. And that Pharaoh is keeping up the tradition of the one before him. Hard slavery, broken lives, brutal existence. But something happens in the story here that changes. And the author of the story is trying to help us see this. It is out of this that the people look up and they begin to pray. They probably start having prayer meetings. Oh God, you spoke to our fathers. You spoke to Abraham. You spoke to Isaac. You spoke to Jacob. But God, it's been 400 years. Nobody's hearing your voice. God, we're crying out to you. They're groaning. You ever have a prayer where all you got is, oh. Amen. Have you ever had that prayer? Paul tells us that sometimes our prayers are too deep for words, that all we can do is groan. And they're groaning. They're crying out to their God. And the first thing that changes in the story is that God is sovereignly leading the people to look up out of their misery, out of the horror of their lives, out of the brokenness. They begin to come together and look up. I just want to tell you that this is so important. The importance of God moving in our lives to draw us to look up, to pray, to draw us to seek him deeply, to gather together and cry out to him. But what's really, really saddening sometimes is that in churches that are comfortable, where things are going well, the one thing that will happen, that it doesn't matter how much you announce, how much you plead, how much you beg, the one thing that is very poorly attended is prayer meetings. Hey, we're going to meet on Friday morning, 6:45. Let's get a big crowd there. Two people show up. Hey, we're going to meet once a quarter. We're going to meet in the church office. We're going to get together and pray and cry out to God. We'll have 15, 20 people. Hey, we're going to blow up huge bounce houses, and we're going to get a ton of our, we're just going to go have fun one night. Man, we'll all show up for that. And what happens here is that the people start doing prayer. That's the meeting that they start attending. That's the one they start going to. That's the one they're starting to be a part of this. God is changing their hearts to cry out to him. And they're praying. But then there's this crazy language. And if you don't understand what's going on here, it's going to seem really weird. It says, and then God, verse 24 says, God heard their groaning. God remembered his covenant with Abraham. God saw the people and God knew. And hear this. The second thing that changes is that God is about to act. This is in the Bible covenant language. Now hear this. This is not like God being like me in the kitchen, okay? When you work in the kitchen, if you're a guy, lay ladies, my wife is so much better than this. But I put a pot of spaghetti on the stove, and then I'm over here cutting up the salad, and then I'm working on this, and I've got these noodles cooking, and I got all this stuff going on all at the same time, and I got some broccoli in a microwave, and you know, I'm cutting up tomato to go in a salad, and all of a sudden I look over and I forgot to put too much water in the pot, and I'm burning the spaghetti noodles, and I get over there and I turn it off real quick, and all of a sudden they're scalded on the bottom of the pan, and I've just absolutely ruined what I was trying to cook because I was so distracted going like eight different directions. If you read this, you think that's what the Bible's saying about God, that what happened was God was so busy doing everything else that all of a sudden his people were like in a pot and they were burning and he forgot and went, oh, stink, I got to deal with this now. That's not what's happening here. When the Bible says that God heard, God saw, God remembered, it's not that he hadn't seen before. It's not that he hadn't heard before. It's not that he forgot about his people. It's that God is now, the Bible is using language that says God, who is in covenant, who is in a relationship with people, who I am your God, you are my people. That's what it means to be in covenant with God. That God is now going to act on behalf of his people. And some of us are here today and our lives are so broken. They're so hard. They're so just, man, it's hard to see our way through anything. I want you to find great comfort in this verse. I think this verse, the way it's laid out, especially the way this translation translates, is so beautiful. Just listen to it. God heard their groaning and he remembered his covenant with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And God saw the people of Israel. And I love this. And God knew. God knew. I don't know where you're at in your life, but just find solace. God knows. It may feel like 400 years of silence, but he is not impotent and he is not busy cutting the salad while the bowl of spaghetti of your life is burning on the stove. God knows. And God rescues his people. And this is what's going to happen in the story, is that God is going to rescue his people. And so let's pick it up. So let's see what happens. It says, now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush, and he looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. Okay, now, sometimes you read Bible language, and it's kind of like, really like, and there was this, and there, you know, and it sounds so formal. So you got to picture what's going on here. Moses hanging out with the sheep. He is doing this every day. His life is boring and monotonous. You know, hanging out with sheep in the desert, it's not like, I want an exciting job. I'm going to be a shepherd, right? It's every day sitting on a rock watching sheep eat what grass there is. And in the midst of this, he sees something that catches his attention. He sees a bush that is burning. Now in the desert, that's not weird. But as he looks at the bush that is burning, he realizes that the leaves are still green and it is not being consumed by the fire. That's weird. Bushes that aren't being burned are green. Bushes that are being burned get consumed. Bushes that are being burned that don't get consumed, that's weird. And so he turned aside. This is going, he's going, what? That is bizarre. That's weird. And so he walks over, curious. He changes the course, takes his eyes off his situation, and looks at this bush just to see what's going on. And all of a sudden, out of the bush, we have, you know, the singing bush experience. You know, back to the video, right? We have God begins to speak. It says an angel of the Lord. Here's one of the things to realize as you're reading the Old Testament. The Bible keeps calling some of these appearances. It will say the angel of the Lord began to speak. The word angel in the original language, in the Hebrew, actually means messenger. Some of the time it refers to a messenger that God sent, i.e. an angel who is, you know, one of these angelic beings that is a created being created by God to bring a message on behalf of God. But there are several times, and this is one of them, just giving you a heads up, where the one who is speaking in the bush is not a created being that God sent. The one in the bush is God himself. And the language of the text makes that very clear, because when God starts talking and he starts having a conversation, the one who's talking to him is God, not an angel on behalf of God. And so it says that the messenger of the Lord, the one speaking, comes out of the bush and begins to speak. And Moses, curious, is coming over. It says, when the Lord saw that he turned aside, God called him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, take your sandals off your feet, for the place which you are standing is holy ground. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. And here we know, Moses knows about God. He knows the story of his people. He's heard the stories of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. He understands that there is a God. He probably has some form of spirituality. He probably prays. Moses knows about this God, but something is going to radically change in this story. And it's the thing that happens to Moses here is what I hope happens to you this morning, is that you go from knowing about God to really knowing God. That's our hope for you at Genesis, that you go maybe from spirituality and some kind of pursuit to truly knowing the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to having a relationship with this God. And so God speaks out of the bush and he talks to him. And the first thing he says is, hey, dude, take off your shoes. Where you're standing is holy ground. Now, interesting phrase here. Because for the most part, when people stand on holy ground, they die. You cannot approach God on your own terms here. You do not say, hey, me and God are going to hang out and I set the terms. God is going to allow Moses to come into a place where sinful humans don't belong. And what he says to Moses, he says, take off your shoes, approach me. But God says, listen, you always need to remember this. When I invite you into my presence, I set the agenda. I set the terms. I am God. You are not. He says, place your staying on this holy ground. And Moses comes, and there begins a conversation between God and Moses, where God is going to call Moses. He says, verse 7, the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people there in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their suffering. I've come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them out of the land that is a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to a place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. And now behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. You hear what God says? This goes back. They started praying. God saw, God heard, God remembered, God knew. God says, now I'm going to act. I am going to deliver my people. And he's going to go on in this whole story to say, and when I do it, it's going to be done in such a way that everybody on this earth will see my mighty hand. The Egyptians will know that I'm God. The Hebrews will know that I'm God. Everybody will know that I have done it. And the whole language of this text is God saying, I will, I will, I will deliver them. I will bring them up. I will call them to myself. I will gather my people. I will rescue them. I will act. That's the story. That's the high story. The high story is never me going, I will. The high story is always God saying, I will, I will. The whole nature of the gospel is moving to me telling God what I will do, to me understanding what God has done and trusting in that. And God says, I will, I will, I will. And the call here is God telling Moses that I am the one who will do this. But then Moses begins to interact with God, and God says, not only am I going to do this, but here you go, Moses, you're going for me. Verse 10, come, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people and the children of Israel out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh? And the rest of chapter 3 and chapter 4 is a conversation between God and Pharaoh that goes like this. God keeps saying, I will do this, but I'm sending you to be the human person who goes for me. And you are going to go to my people and speak for me. And you are going to go to Pharaoh and speak more for me. I am going to send you. And Moses, God is saying, I will. I am the God who's going to do this. And Moses then starts, he ends up giving 5 excuses that says, yo, God, great. I love the idea. God, this is awesome. Deliver your people. But you got the wrong dude. You chose the wrong guy. I am not this. I tried it once, didn't go well. I kind of like my rock. I kind of like my sheep. I kind of like the boredom. I am not in. I don't want to be a part of this. And God says, I'm going to act. And Moses says, I am not the guy. I am not the guy. And he gives a few objections. He gives five objections. The first time, and I'm just going to tell you what these are. You can look them up. The first one is here. And Moses basically says, I'm a nobody. Same me. I'm nobody. I'm just some dude out in the desert. Nobody's even going to remember me back there. I got nothing. I'm not somebody who can do this. And sometimes this is our first excuse. God, I know. I mean, it's cool that you want great things to happen. I'm all for that. But here's the deal. I can't do this. I'm nobody. I got nothing to offer. I'm not able. Moses goes on to dialogue with God, and his second objection is he says, I don't even know who you are. I mean, I get spirituality, but truth is, I have great doubts. I'm not real sure I get you, God. Can I really trust you? I don't know really who you are. His third objection, he says, listen, God, here's the deal. People will think I'm nuts. I mean, God, seriously, picture this. This is what you want me to do, right, God? You want me to march back into Egypt. You want me to go to your people and say, I was out in the desert, I was watching my sheep, and a burning bush talked to me, so I want you to follow me and leave Egypt. They're going to think, you've lost your rocker, man. Let's check you into a facility. You need help. You're not right in the head. A bush, really? A bush talked to you? Seriously? They're not going to believe a word I say. They're not going to, they're going to think I'm crazy. You ever feel that way? You're like, okay, I get this God thing, but really to go do anything that's real for him, people look at me and think I'm the nut job in the group. I'm the crazy person because I believe these ideas that nobody else can see, and I just feel like people will think I'm nuts. Moses though goes on. His next thing is he just says, hey, man, I'm not able to do this. Seriously, I can't do this. He basically, the way he says this is he says, I stutter all the time. I can't speak right. You want me to go be your spokesperson, God. You're calling a dude who stutters to be your spokesperson. I can't do that. And every step along the way so far, God has answered his objection with some really cool miracles, some signs. And God's answer is never, all right, Moses, you will. God's answer every time is, I will, you go. I will, you go. I will, you go. And Moses finally says, no, I'm not doing it. His last objection is, I don't want to do this. I find somebody else. And at this point in time, the text says, in chapter 4, the text says, the anger of the Lord burned against Moses. In other words, God is saying, you will or you'll die. Here's your options. And he says, I've even given you a brother. He's good at speaking. Go with him. Get him. He's going to meet you. And God orchestrates everything in Moses' life because Moses says, listen, I am not. I'm not the dude. And God's answer is, oh, yes, you are. You have all the gifts and the abilities you need. God's answer is, I know you are not able. I know you can't, but I will. And in the middle of this conversation, there is this crazy exchange where God introduces himself with a new name, a different name. My dad grew up in the 50s, right? He actually graduated from this high school early 1960s. Actually graduated in 1960 from Eureka High School. My daughter was hanging out in the school this week looking through an old yearbook and found a picture of her grandpa in the Eureka High School library yearbooks, right? So he graduated 1960 from here. He went to play junior college basketball, and his boyhood idol was Mickey Mantle. Just loved Mickey Mantle. I don't know if he had posters, but if you imagine a kid today, he probably had Mickey Mantle posters, had trading cards, had all this stuff about his stats, would always choose him first on his, baseball fantasy team, whatever you would do. My dad was really into Mickey Mantle. He just, kind of his boyhood hero was all about Mickey Mantle. And my dad went to play college basketball at a place called Moberly Junior College, which is in central Missouri. And while he was there, he ended up with a guy roommating, and the guy who was his roommate was a young man named Bart Mantle. My dad's thinking, that's interesting, and starts talking with him, and sure enough, he is now a roommate with Mickey Mantle's brother. He is literally rooming with Mickey Mantle's brother. And one time, they were on a road trip. They took a road trip, like, more towards New York, and on the road trip, Bart Mantle's brother decided to come hang out for a few days and came to wherever they were playing. And my dad literally went out and had ice cream and hung out one evening, and then the next day just hung out with this guy that he knew, Mickey Mantle. My dad knew everything there was to know about him. He knew his stats. He knew how many home runs he hit. He knew what he was like. Probably knew even some of the stories about him, but still was like, hey, great guy. Just love him as a baseball player. My dad knew all kinds of stuff about Mickey Mantle. But he didn't know Mickey Mantle. But on that day, he met Mickey Mantle. And I can just imagine sitting across the table going, Mr. Mantle, it's so good to meet you. You get kind of this feeling when you meet somebody like that. Mr. Mantle, I'm sorry. And can you imagine sitting across the table where he goes, hey, man, my friends call me Mick. And the invitation to say, man, this formal name, Mickey Mantle, Mr. Mantle. Now, the invitation to my dad comes in to say, listen, you now know me. You have a relationship with me. Because of that, I want you to call me something different. I want you to call me what my friends call me. There's a crazy exchange here. We're in the midst of the conversation where Moses is saying, I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't do this. And God says, I will. I will. That Moses says, when I go to the people, who am I supposed to say sent me? Look at this. Let's see, we are going to be in verse, I gotta look here in my notes. Verse 13. It says, then Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me, and they say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to my people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Jacob, Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and I am to be remembered throughout all generations. In other words, here's what God says. God says, my friends call me I am. This is my name for people that I am relationship. This is now going to be my covenant name. The people I have a relationship with, they call me I am, which is weird. Like anybody who knows grammar is like, huh? Because if you walk up to me in the hallway afterwards, you say, hey, Mike, how are you? And I look at you and go, I am. You're going to have that moment of awkward silence, like, you are what? That's right. Because we don't speak in these terms, because we know the to be verb has to have a qualifier. I am hungry. I am hot. I am, going to the ball game. Something has to come after I am. You don't just go, I am. That's weird. And Moses says, all right, here's the deal. Who are you? What's your name? What am I going to tell the people your name is? And God says, here's what I want you to tell them. Tell them that I am that I am. Tell them I am has sent you. And you can hear Moses going, huh? You are what? That's the name of my friends. My friends call me I am. Those who are tight with me, they call me I am. And Moses kind of got this weird thing going, you are what? And then he goes, not only do I want you to call me that, but say the Lord, the God who has sent you, this is going to be my name forever. Those who are friends, those who are close to me, for all generations, I want them to know me as I am. And there's two core ideas that are being expressed here by God. Maybe more. I want to let you know that the truth is, as you study the Bible, you will never get to the bottom of the depths of what God is trying to say to Abraham here. But two big ideas. One will make your head spin a little bit. The other one's easier because one's a little more philosophical. So you got to hang with me just for my moment where I like philosophy, okay? What God is saying, first of all, is that he just is. You and I are dependent. We don't just exist. We have a beginning. We have an end. We're dependent on air. We're dependent on other people. We're dependent on there's just a bajillion things that you and I, our existence is dependent on. And not only this, we are always becoming. We are changing. We are going from what I am today to what I am tomorrow. And some of us have hopes that I am this today, but tomorrow I hope to be. And our language is not really, what we find our hope in is not what I am, but what I someday will be. And even as Christians, if we've come to a realization that I'm going to get old and it's not going to get better, we at least know someday I will be changed in the likeness of Jesus. But our existence is dependent and it's always changing. And when God says, I am, the first thing he's letting us know is that he just is. He is pure existence. He is not dependent on anything else. He does not need me or you. He does not need the universe. He just is. He is not changing. He is. He is the great I am. And he is a bedrock that never changes and never depends on anybody. He is able. He is capable. He is God. But the name for God in those cultures was the name El, which means like the great God. But God now says, listen, I want you, when you're in relationship with me, to go from just calling me El, calling me God, to calling me I am. And that's one of the ways that's used all throughout the Bible, that this is a great God who just is. But the other way is that there is a little bit of like a blank check being written here, a little bit of saying to Moses, here's the deal. Whatever you come to in life, whatever happens in your world, wherever you are at and my people are at, it is at that moment that I will fill in the blank. And there's something crazy that goes on in the Old Testament with this word, because the verb to be is Haya. So, I mean, I just love it. God says, Moses says, what's my name? And he goes, my name is Haya. Like, you know, sounds like, you know, he's doing karate. But then there's a play on this in this verb, this word that maybe some of you have heard, this name for God that is the name Yahweh. The name Yahweh. And the name Yahweh basically is the name, the Old Testament name for God that is used all throughout the Old Testament. And it refers, it is from the verb to be. It comes from this encounter where God says, I want to be known as I am. Well, what happens is, as translators have translated, especially translators who are Hebrew, and they get the Ten Commandments, and one of the Ten Commandments is don't ever use the name of the Lord your God in vain. They don't ever want this name for God rolling off their lips in a way that is blasphemous, so they change it from the word Yahweh to the word Adonai in texts that are read. Adonai means Lord. They would read it, it would say Adonai, but in their head they would understand this was this special name that was just between them and God. And where that name lands is the term Jehovah. Have you ever heard the term Jehovah, the name for God Jehovah? It is the Hebrew people actually just changing vowel marks of Yahweh so they don't accidentally use this name in a way that's loose or in vain. And here's what happens in the Old Testament. Is that the name Jehovah all through the Old Testament is translated over and over and over again. And as you read it in English Bibles, anywhere you come across the word Lord, the Lord your God, the Lord Almighty, and the word Lord is all caps, capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. What you have is the original language giving you this name. It is the name that only God's friends, only those in relationship with God get to call him. I am. And what happens is you read the Old Testament, then there are all these places where God's people get themselves in a situation or there's a struggle or there is a battle or something happens. And God gets all these names out of the Old Testament where he fills in the blank. And so you were here a couple weeks ago. We talked about the Abraham and Isaac story. And God delivers, gives them a ram. He provides. And God, Abraham says, we're going to call this place. And what the text says is the Lord will provide. Actually, the name there is Jehovah Jireh. I am the provider. Because what happened? They came to a situation where God needed to provide a lamb. Who was God at that point? I am the one who provides. And it goes on. The Bible keeps going. There are several places all throughout the Old Testament where God says, I am the one who heals you. I am the Lord. I am the healer. Or I am the good, I am the shepherd. If you read Psalm 23, it says, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. It really says, I am Jehovah, the shepherd. And all through the Old Testament, this name is used in such a way where there is a blank after the great I am. And at the moment God's people need him, he comes through and becomes that for them. And this is the beautiful promise. As God interacts with Moses and God speaks to Moses, God says, listen, my friends call me I am. And this becomes the holy, reverent, awesome name for his people. But see, I've told you over and over again, everything in the Bible is about Jesus. And so we got to end this by telling you, well, how does this connect to Jesus? And in the story of Jesus, a guy named John, who is one of Jesus' best friends, writes Jesus' stories. And as John is explaining to us Jesus' life, several times where Jesus is hanging out with people talking, he begins to use language like this. He says, I am the great shepherd of the sheep. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the gate. And what happens as you read this, if you know this whole story, if you understand this backdrop, you understand what's going on in this story where Moses meets God. Moses goes from knowing about God to literally knowing God. Moses goes from having an idea of spirituality to having a relationship with God. And God looks at Moses and says, hey, my friends call me, I am. If you understand that and you get to the New Testament, you start reading this and Jesus starts using this language, you go, what's going on? But lest we think this is missed, there are four times in the Gospel of John where somebody asked Jesus, who are you? In some way, shape, or form, they go, Jesus, who are you? And his answer four different times in the Gospel of John is, I am. I'm going to show you one of those. In John chapter 8, verse 56, Jesus is having a debate with the religious leaders. And as he's talking to the religious leaders, he is dealing with these men who already have a bone to pick with him. This conversation is going to get Jesus killed. And this is what he says. Your father Abraham, Jesus is talking. Your father Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day. He saw it, was glad. Listen to what he's saying. Abraham was looking forward to me. When God made the promises to Abraham, Abraham began to realize that someday a seed would come. Abraham was looking forward to me. The religious leaders go, huh? They say to him, the Jews said to him, you're not even 50 years old and you've seen Abraham? Dude, that dude lived a couple thousand years ago. You've been on this earth about 50 years and you're trying to tell me you knew who Abraham was? You know Abraham was looking forward to you? Really? You know Abraham? And look at Jesus' answer. Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. Next verse. They picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. In other words, they were going to try to kill him right there. Why? Because any Hebrew knew that Jesus looked at him and goes, hey, boys, you know the story of Moses? You know the story of the burning bush? You know when Moses went over and the bush wasn't burning? I mean, it wasn't consuming. The leaves were green. And Moses met God. And God gave Moses an invitation to join him in what he was doing. And he said, God, who are you? And he said, I am. Hey, boys, that was me. I was talking in the bush. The messenger of the Lord is standing in your midst. And they tried to kill him right there, and eventually they do for this very claim. Anybody who ever looks at you and says, Jesus never claimed to be God, doesn't understand the God of the Bible. He claimed very clearly to be the one that had delivered them from slavery. And God spoke. And the Bible's connecting us to Jesus. And here we are today, and our lives are rough, and they're hard. And we get trapped in the small story. In a small story, we begin to realize, I am not. I am not. I just wish God would act, because I am not. I can't make it work. And that's where Moses was. But what the Bible is hoping is that you go from just this phrase, I am not. Or maybe you're in the phrase where you're like, I am. I can handle my life. I can do it. I can make it work. That's where Moses was in Exodus 1 when he kills the Egyptian. Moses goes, I am. By the time we get to Exodus 3, Moses goes, I am not. I can't do this. This is not me. And by the time Moses leaves this conversation, this is what Moses is going to say to the people. I am not. But I know I am. He's going to look at the Hebrew people and go, I'm nothing, but I know I am. He's going to look at Pharaoh and say, I am not, but you better listen because I know I am, and he's going to act to deliver us. If you don't obey him, it's not going to go well. And that's your hope and my hope today. It's not that I can do it. It's to live my life knowing in my small story there is a big story, and the big story is a God who invites us into relationship and invites us to realize every day, I am not, but then to live knowing I am. And the great I am is Jesus. He is the one who shows us God. He is the one who introduces us to who he is. He is the one who reveals his character. And so wherever you're at today, your hope is to go today from knowing about to humbly looking to Jesus and meeting Jesus. To go from knowing about God to having God look at you and go, hey, my friends, call me I am. My friends, call me Jesus. That's your hope. Lord, we love you today. We praise you for this story and what it teaches, and just pray that you will speak to it, out of it into our lives and call us into deep pursuit, deep knowledge. Lord, some of us today in this time of worship right now, we need a burning bush. We need a moment where you literally speak out of something in our lives that just catches us where we didn't expect it. My prayer today is that you will move in us, you will shape us, you will help us to know you, to meet you, to really see that the great I am is in our midst. Thank you, Jesus, for being all that we need. In your name I pray. Amen.